So Eric, can you give us tell us what permaculture is all about for those of us who don't really know that much about it?
Sure.
It's a big that's a big question, I know.
Yeah. Well, permaculture, which it could be permanent agriculture or permanent culture. That's kind of where the words come from. Well, it's about designing human culture that is beneficial to the land and to humans at the same time. So really, it's how do we design, say, our landscapes or our communities in a way where we have food and water and energy, and that we can live in a peaceful culture and we can have the abundance around us, yet at the same time that we're healing the earth and caring for the needs of the earth and understanding the limits in which we live in from the ecosphere, you know, from their surrounding environment. So it's really about building, it's about designing relationships between elements like water, elements like shelter, and governance and economy. Because most sciences, most design sciences and practices, even in gardening or sustainability, focus more on specific elements, you know, like creating your solar house or whatnot. But in permaculture, it's really more about how do we design all of the elements in a holistic system. And it's also about being site-specific. I think something that can be a misconception sometimes with permaculture is that you learn from one person or you read one book and there's a thought that it can be applied, that just that one technique can be applied anywhere. But really permaculture is about being site-specific, listening and observing a community's problems and a community's resources, and then designing from those observations.
And that in itself is a relationship too, eh? Like you need it, and it like requires relationship, I guess, which is kind of cool because our current culture doesn't require any relationship really. It's all about abstracting ourselves from relationship.
Exactly. And nature, you know, and abstracting ourselves from nature, you know, is what we see a lot in our current culture. And the goal of a good permaculture design or of the permaculture movement is about remembering that we are nature working and modeling our patterns off of the harmonious patterns that you would find in a forest or a prairie or some natural system that is pristine and healthy, and that these patterns of diversity and these patterns of energy efficiency and regeneration are patterns that we can apply through design into our communities and our situations. And it can be applied on any scale. It can be applied on a personal relationship scale, and it can be applied on a large city governance policy scale.
So in a world of, in an economic system where we're taught about scarcity, where does abundance come in, and how does that relate to like a permaculture view?
That's a great question. In this world that we're taught about scarcity, it comes from a disconnect. I think the scarcity model comes from a disconnect with nature and a disconnect of where our resources actually come from. In the scarcity model world that we have, most people don't know where their water is coming from. Most people don't know where their food is coming from, and in fact don't even know how to grow their own food. The way permaculture relates in terms of abundance is understanding that nature, anywhere on the earth, there are forms of abundance that come from the sun and the earth and the water, and the rain, the wind, that all of these forms of energy that are around us, surrounding us all the time, the plants and the animals, these are all forms of abundance only if we choose to see them as forms of abundance and be in relationship with them. But often in permaculture community, we talk about the abundance consciousness, which really relates to the third ethic of permaculture, because there's three ethics: care of earth, care of people, and fair share, or return the surplus. And that third ethic, return the surplus, that's about abundance consciousness. That's about knowing that abundance comes in regenerative cycles, meaning that if you're in right relationship with your community and your surrounding environment, that abundance will continually come in cycles throughout the year in different forms. And that there might be an opportunity, there might be a point where you have surplus of something. Maybe it's apples, maybe it's time. And that if you share that surplus with the community, then you'll be, that's abundance consciousness right there. And that form of abundance consciousness of sharing those apples or sharing that time is going to create abundance with whoever you're sharing it with or whatever you're sharing it with, which then adds to the cycle of regeneration, which creates more abundance. Mm-hmm. And if we follow this path of abundance consciousness, of return the surplus, then we're on a path towards abundance forever, really, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's really about that disconnect from nature, from looking around and, you know, seeing the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think that sustainability is such a catchphrase, but abundance takes it a step further almost, not just sustainable, but giving more back than just merely sustaining the current level of consumption or production or whatnot.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
This is, I mean, and that's another super important point too, because we need to start making the distinction between, I mean, in fact, a lot of these words have been manipulated to mean various things. And now the word sustainability is losing some of its, you know, what are you sustaining? Sustainability of what? Mm-hmm. Able to sustain what, you know? And there's, you know, a business model might be, you know, to sustain the financial profit, right? So yeah, moving it a step further, and that's why we use these words abundance and regeneration, you know, what we're talking about is not, yeah, just like you said, not just sustaining the current situation or, but moving into a place of actually creating more than what there is. And that can only be done in good relationship with the earth and each other, really. Mm. That care of earth and that care of people. That one thing we learn is that as humans, we've created all these problems, you know, we've created desertification and we've created poverty and we've destroyed the earth and we've polluted the rivers and all of these effects that have happened from our ingenuity and our disconnect with nature. But there's a principle in permaculture, which is the problem is the solution. And we as humans are kind of the main problem, but we're also the main solution. And that if we choose to care for each other in a way that encourages sharing and encourages peace and nonviolence, that's one step towards moving towards this regenerative culture, a permanent culture where people are cared for and the earth is cared for. But you can't have one without the other. You can't care for the earth without caring for the people. And you can't care for the people without caring for the earth. And so they're intimately linked. And this is sort of a new concept, I think, in movements, sustainability movements and social justice movements. And, you know, let's talk about movements for a sec, that largely in the past, they've been very disconnected. There's been movements for racial justice and women's rights and civil rights and very important campaigns and movements for people to care for people. But people still need to eat. People still drink water. People still need to live in houses. And so just focusing on the rights is only one step in the process of moving towards a culture of abundance. And on the other end, you have environmentalist movements that focus on saving the rivers and saving the forest and cleaning up toxic land. Often these movements have not taken into account the social webs that brought about this destruction. And if we're only focusing on conservation and only focusing on saving the old growth redwoods, say in this area, then we miss the point that there are patterns happening in the social structure, like big business and government policy, that will continually defeat our campaigns because we're not thinking holistically. So permaculture, bring it back to permaculture, is about thinking holistically and mm-hmm. looking at all of these movements and seeing what are the ways that these movements can link and become a holistic, I like to call it the holistic revolution of change towards cultures of abundance.
So you talked a bunch about patterns here, like the word patterns has come up. And how do you define patterns from a permaculture perspective or from this holistic perspective, and how do they fit into what you're talking about?
So, I mean, the basic definition are patterns are processes that repeat themselves, or things that repeat themselves are a pattern. But patterns are a way of, observing patterns are a way of finding out what's going on. For instance, when a forest is clear cut, observing the water flow on that landscape, or observing the animal relationships on that clear cut forest, these are patterns that we can observe. And they will indicate something. They can indicate health, they can indicate sickness. And so, for one, we just have to step back and be able to observe the patterns going on, not delve so deep into the details of those patterns, but just the pattern itself. And as a starting point, by observing these patterns, we can start to observe how we can actually influence beneficial patterns to occur. As well, going back to the sort of the beginning of just observing how nature works and how nature functions, and that if we take that premise that we are nature working, that we are nature, well then, a pattern that works in nature, a cooperation between a mycelium fungi, a mycorrhizal fungi, and a tree and a strawberry, that this beneficial relationship of the tree sending sugars through the mycorrhizal fungi and feeding the strawberry that's growing in the shade, but it still puts off the ripe fruit, that this pattern of cooperation, through observing it, we can yield inspiration for ourselves and our own cultures. And now let's take that and apply it to human systems. And how can we be in cooperation with each other?
There's a real mystical element to patterns too. I wonder if you can talk a bit about, like, it kind of, like, patterns seem to touch or at least illuminate a bit more of the magic that's going on kind of around us and within us.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. I think we talked about this earlier too, so I'll just go right straight to that and just say that for a moment, just feel your heart beating and then take a breath and one thing you might observe is that both the heart beating and the breath, that these functions, one thing that's happening is that there's an expansion that's occurring, like your heart and your lungs, and there's a contraction that's occurring, like when you exhale. This expanding and contracting pattern is one that is universal in nature and is a building block for the continuation of life. Some other places we can see this pattern, now we've sort of observed them in our bodies, the heartbeat, the breath. Well, we can observe this pattern by thinking of the ocean, and that tides come in far onto the land, and then they come out again. And that this pattern is the same as the pattern of us breathing. There's an expansion and a contraction, and that allows for life to keep living and continuing. And that tidal pattern is directly connected to the moon and the pattern of a waxing and waning moon, which drives many patterns of expansion and contraction. Like the sap in a tree is also related to a moon cycle. Like a woman who is menstruating is also connected, deeply connected to that pattern of the ocean tide, and that pattern of us taking a breath, and that pattern of us, of our hearts beating. And so this is where the mystical piece comes in. Another one I'll just throw out there is if you just look at your veins and imagine that the blood in your body is taking nutrients and oxygen to all parts of your body, to your fingertips and your toes. And that this pattern of our veins, which looks like the branching of a tree, is the same thing that happens in a tree with the saps and the energy and the sugars. That a tree branching is also, those branches are carrying the nutrients to the tips of the tips of the leaves, just like those branches are doing it in our bodies. And then take it one step further and say, and look at how a watershed, a creek with all of its streams and all of its springs and its tributaries, that if you look at that on a map, or you look at that top down, you'll notice that it's the same exact branching pattern that is in our veins and in this the stems of the trees. And that the water across the landscape, there's this thing in, you know, alternative cultures that water is the blood of the earth. Well, that's not an alternative thing. That's just basically the truth, that water acts on the surface of the earth the same way that veins act in our body to distribute oxygen and nutrients to all the parts of the system.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Really, it breaks right through that anthropocentrism, eh?
Yeah. It can be pretty humbling and empowering at the same time. It's humbling to the fact that, okay, we really need to see ourselves within the ecosphere and not humans as the dominators in the earth within something that we dominate. But when we actually see ourselves within the ecological systems around us, within it and part of it, like the tree, it can be humbling but inspiring, because we can also draw upon that energy. And I think it's an important inspiration that permaculture brings to people who want to make change in the world, is that we can work within nature, which is another principle of permaculture. And that by working within nature, we can draw upon these patterns, and we can draw upon the forces of the sun and the forces of the wind and the cyclones and the soil microorganisms. And all of these are allies to us in creating change. And that by acknowledging that we're nature, we can actually make use of these energies in a beneficial way.
Yeah, I like that. You're talking about allies, like having allies in nature and also being allies with nature. Maybe let's talk about some ways that, like, we can actually, like, heal the earth, and maybe, like, connecting it to the whole, within and without, like how scorched earth is kind of like scabs in our body, or like deserts are kind of like third degree burns in our body. And you spoke a bit of how we can turn, can you talk a bit about how we can, reverse the process of desertification, which is, maybe talk a bit about what desertification is, like what's going on right now.
Yeah.
To start off with.
And I'll just add to I'll start off with adding to your point about the scarcification, because if you imagine, or you look and you see a place where the soil is bare, where the earth is bare, like in a desert, This is like having an open wound on the body. And often in our gardens and in our communities, we'll make the ground bare. We'll scrape what we call weeds off to make ground bare, to maybe to plant something else, or maybe because we don't like to see the weeds there or whatnot. But what's happening when those weeds grow is they're like a scab that's going to protect the open wound of that bare soil. So if we think of the bare soil as an open wound, then, and we see weeds as an immunological response to an open wound to create a scab to protect, let's move that now into the scale of a desert. And that humans, in our practices of overgrazing, of depleting groundwater aquifers, of increased development and deforestation, these are all human practices that have happened around the world, and all of these practices will result and do result in desertification, in taking, say, what once was a forest, where when water landed on that forest, it was absorbed by the earth. There was organic matter and topsoil feeding plants and trees and animals and insects. and creating forms of abundance that for all creatures to share. But you take those trees away and you scrape that topsoil off. And when the water lands on that, now it can't absorb. And it runs off the surface and it takes more topsoil with it. And it creates these open wounds that have a hard time healing, especially with our that we continually will do these patterns. And so it's about how do we support those parts of the earth, these places where we've created deserts, how do we support their immunological response again? How do we support them in covering up those open wounds and growing into forms of abundance? And once you get to a place of a desert, it really is all about water, and that most plants can't grow without much water. And so a desert ecosystem, or a system that we've turned into a desert, we need to start with how do we rehydrate that? Because you can think of it as that we just dehydrated, like when the body gets dehydrated, that part of the earth is super dehydrated and it needs to be rehydrated before the processes of immune building and abundance can come back again. So in permaculture and in restoration practices, there's the process of infiltrating water, getting that water to, rather than run across the surface of the soil, how do you infiltrate it into the subsurface where it can be absorbed by the soil and will actually be held in the landscape? And one technique is by using what we call a swale. A swale is a ditch that runs along contour. So if you don't know what contour is, check out a topographical map. And if you look at a topo map and you see all the squiggly lines, those are contour lines. And what they mean, and what they are, is they are perpendicular to slope. That you have, let's say you dug a ditch on contour. What that would mean is that when water was running off the slope above your ditch, it would hit the ditch, and then rather than running to one direction, it would actually fill it up, like filling up a bathtub. And this is taking water that might be running and teaching it to walk, and teaching it to actually fall asleep. So now, as you imagine, this long ditch on contour catches water and starts to hold that water in this ditch like a bathtub would, that it gives time for that water to be absorbed by the soil. So in deserts, there's clouds going by all the time, but they're not dropping rain, because clouds need something to slow them down. They need mountains, they need wind, they need trees, they need something to slow them down enough to release the rain. But they're blowing by because a desert is a desert. But every once in a great while, there'll be a little rain in the desert. And what happens when it does rain in the desert is what we call flash floods. So the water doesn't get absorbed and it just rushes along the surface down all, following slopes and following low points, and rushes out as fast as it can, whatever drainages there might be. So let's say we dug one of these huge contour ditches in that desert, and the 2 or 3 inches of rain that happened a year in that desert occurred. Well, what would happen is that water would be rushing, and then it would hit this ditch, which is perpendicular to slope, which is on contour, and it would fill that ditch up like a big bathtub of all this water. And that water would slowly percolate into the ground because it has nothing else to do, nowhere else to go but down. And as that water percolates into the ground, what happens is the soil, there's space in the soil, what we call pore space. And water has surface tension. Like if you've ever filled a glass full of water to the very, very brim, and you see like a little bubble that goes beyond the rim of the glass, that's surface tension in water. Well, water does the same thing in soil. So as that water is sitting in this ditch like a bathtub and it percolates down, it's holding on to itself and it's percolating into the pore spaces of the soil. And what happens is it creates what we call a water lens. So it's actually a mini aquifer. Some of that water might drain out and go away, but for the most part, that water is going to be held underneath the ditch. after a few years, that water lens, that mini aquifer, will actually grow more and more and more the more years that go by and rain fills the ditch and it gets to infiltrate. So once you develop a water lens, you can actually come back and plant trees. And here we're talking about a desert here. So these trees never would have been able to make it without having some water to tap into. In most cases, irrigating a desert is not a very smart thing to do. So, but you can make use of this water lens that you've created, this mini aquifer, and you can plant trees that can actually tap into that water. Now, if you want to actually return this desert into a rainforest, or you want to return this desert into a prairie or a redwood forest, then you're going to need more rain. And so you want to plant those first trees you plant. You want them to be trees that can grow really fast. Because as these trees grow up, they're tapped into this mini aquifer, they start to create shade, which will reduce evaporation. They start to build soil from their roots and from their leaf fall, starts to create topsoil, which also holds more water and starts attracting insects and soil microorganisms and birds and all kinds of creatures that start to make use of this now beginning of life in the desert. Once these trees reach the height of 40 feet, an interesting thing happens where when wind hits, say, a windbreak of trees that are 40 feet tall. So you've planted these trees, now they've grown 40 feet tall. Well, it actually bounces the wind up into the air. It ramps it up into the sky. And that extra wind that gets ramped up into the sky from hitting the trees can help slow clouds down and bring more rain into the system. And also the process of the wind blowing into these trees, there's another process that we call evapotranspiration, which is the process where a plant is transpiring moisture. And of course, in this case, it's getting its moisture from that water lens you created. So it's transpiring moisture. And the wind, when it blows through, is evaporating that moisture into the air. And this helps create more clouds, which helps create more rain. Mm. And now this process can be somewhat left alone. And all of our allies of the birds and the squirrels and all the creatures will be attracted to this new life, and they'll start planting the next succession of trees and plants. And soon, you know, years into the future, this what was once a desert can actually be returned to a place of abundance and fertility and life.
Beautiful story. Do you know where this is happening at all around the world?
Well, I've heard that in Australia, that Bill Mollison, who is a co-founder of permaculture, has done these practices in Australia. And also in New Mexico, actually, there are some places in New Mexico and Arizona that way back when, I think it was Roosevelt, the president of the United States in the early part of the century, the 20th century, he helped fund, because there was a loss of topsoil we were still a heavily agriculture-based country, because of the loss of topsoil, he helped actually fund projects to return topsoil and fertility to the lands. And one project he funded was in the Southwest, where they dug large swales. And if you go there now, you'll walk through a desert and you'll get to these large swales, and they're completely green and full of life.
Cool.
So they're pretty amazing. There's Bill Mollison has a video he put out called The Global Gardener. And in this Global Gardener, you can take a trip around the world and see how permaculture has been applied in different places. And he goes to the Southwest where these swales were dug and observes what happened there. So that's a reference for people.
Right on. That's really, really cool. And on the topic of healing the earth, do you want to talk a bit about mushrooms and how they're more than just, you know, for eating or tripping out with, but how they're like really powerful allies in healing the earth?
Yeah. So just lately now, just in the last few years, there's been some amazing research around the use of mushrooms in cleaning toxins up in the earth. And mainly done by a man by the name of Paul Stamets out of Olympia, Washington. And his organization is called Fungi Perfecti. And what he found is that mushrooms can break hydrocarbon bonds. Hydrocarbon bonds are the basis for most man-made chemicals and for oil and diesel gasoline. So these highly toxic substances that humans have either created or mined out of the earth that we've brought onto the surface where they really shouldn't be, creates devastation in the ecosystem. And that these mushrooms can actually, up until finding this out, people didn't really know how to break a hydrocarbon bond. But mushrooms can actually do this. So they did a test in Washington on a pile, 15-yard pile of soil that was laden with diesel gasoline. And they had multiple piles of this. And they tested, they had bacterial testing and all different forms to see what cleaned this oil up the best. And mushrooms was one of those forms that Paul Stamets helped initiate this. And what they found was that after a couple weeks, mushrooms were actually growing in the pile. Whereas every other pile still looked like dead, toxic soil. There was some life happening. And after a couple more weeks, there were actually plants growing, birds playing, and all sorts of life occurring on this soil, this pile of soil that was once laden with diesel gasoline. And so through testing it, what they found is that the mushroom itself actually broke the hydrocarbon bond, gassed off the carbon, which created a completely benign substance then, where the mushroom theoretically could actually be eaten, although we wouldn't suggest eating it, but that it could be eaten, that there were no traces of harmful chemical gasoline there. And so the research has gone further, and now what we found is that mushrooms can clean up all kinds of chemicals, all sorts of chemicals that people didn't know how to deal with before. And they do that in a variety of ways. They can clean water, and they can clean soil. And as well, there are certain situations where there's heavy metals, like a lot of people, a few decades ago, they used a lot of lead-based paints to paint houses. And those old houses, the paint's flaked off, and lead gets into the soil. And so we have all of this polluted soil that's full of lead. Well, we found that oyster mushrooms can actually accumulate the lead out of the soil and push it into its fruit body. So the fruit body is what we all usually call the mushroom, the thing that looks like a mushroom. But the mushroom itself is actually more the underground part of it, what we call mycelium, which is a white webbing substance. And this mycelium has the ability to produce many, many, many kinds of enzymes. And actually, some mushrooms can produce over 100 enzymes. So an oyster mushroom, for example, could break down a wood chip, it could break down a log, and it could break down Roundup, and it could break down diesel, and it can accumulate lead. So the way that it has this diverse ability to deal with these toxins that have ladened our soils and our waters around the world is because it can produce such a variety of enzymes that it can adapt to whatever food that it's creeping up upon and turn that into a resource.
It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And in fact, they actually say that the spore of a mushroom is one of the only things that can live in space, and that it can actually enter our atmosphere and still be viable when it hits. So there is speculation that mushrooms are actually from outer space and were seeded. The planet was actually seeded by mushrooms through meteorites long ago. And just to add to the story, one thing they found, it's important to note that our present day culture is actually in some ways less sophisticated and our understanding of nature and natural processes than our ancient ancestors, you know, indigenous cultures of these lands that were understood these types of processes much more. And actually, when we talk about permaculture, it's sort of taking, it's sort of like implementing indigenous wisdom into modern day society. And a lot of indigenous cultures worked on the premise of natural patterns and saw themselves as part of the system. And this is part of the inspiration for permaculture. And there was the Iceman that was found. It's pretty well known, found in the Alps in Switzerland. And this was about 10,000 years ago that this Iceman was found, that this Iceman got caught in a glacier and was frozen. And so they found this Iceman, and what they found on this Iceman, they found three different kinds of mushrooms on this Iceman. And this just tells us a little bit about how much of our knowledge of our relationship with mushrooms has like disappeared, because they actually had much more of an understanding. What they found was that there were three types. One type was an antibiotic, that because there are actually a lot of mushroom varieties that are antibiotics. Another type was a type that they could actually pound this mushroom into a sort of felt, and that they had this Iceman had made a container made out of the mushroom, and that this container was actually able to carry an ember of fire, so that part of the survival, and this is what we think is maybe part of the actual basis for survival of those people living in an ice age, living high in the mountains, is part of the ability, how do you carry fire? Because fire in a cold type of place is kind of basis for life. And they found that they were actually able to carry fire in a mushroom. And this is how they were able to make it through the harshest and most cold winters and actually travel from one place to another.
What was the third type of mushroom on?
The third type of mushroom, I believe they had made a hat. The Iceman had had a hat that was actually made from a similar mushroom that was the felt was pounded out into an actual hat. And Paul Stamets, he's grown out this Iceman fungus, and he's made himself a hat out of some of the ones he's grown out to model how this is used.
So can people learn more about this through Paul Stamets' work then?
Yes, yeah. Which his organization is Fungi Perfecti, but I believe the website is fungi.org.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And so being that we're living in a time now where we can see the industrial model somewhat collapsing around us. We can see that non-renewable resources like oil are becoming less and less available and more expensive. And this process, which we could call energy descent, that we have all this energy that has been stored, like in fossil fuels, and we've been using up all this stored energy, but little by little, this stock of energy starts to get diminished, and the energy resources we're using are ones that replenish in a geologic timescale, so they take, you know, millions of years to actually replenish. Mm-hmm. So looking at this model, that our whole industrial, most of our human systems around the earth have been based upon energy resources that are not being renewed and that are slowly depleting, we can observe this pattern and say that there's potential for an energy crisis to occur. And I would venture to say that there is an energy crisis occurring right now. Because we've built all of our systems, our cars, how we get food from one place to another, industrial models of agriculture are all based on petroleum-based chemicals, on tractors that guzzle fuel, And that all these systems are based on that. And as this energy descent occurs, we as a humanity needs to find a new way. And when we really look to it, it's not a new way. It's actually ancient wisdom that we need to tap into. It's our ancient, it's our ancestral, it's what our ancestors have done to survive that we need to draw inspiration from and pattern ourselves around. But because we live in this modern day culture where we have skyscrapers and cars and we've depleted so much arable land and we've cut forests and we've turned rainforests into desert, we're not actually living in the same place that our ancestors were living in when they were living in harmony with nature. So our practice needs to be, how can we create abundance? How can we regenerate the disturbed lands mm-hmm. and move beyond sustainability, move beyond just caring for our needs? But let's think about the future. Let's think about seven generations into the future, which is what many indigenous cultures have based a lot of their culture around, is like, you know, working for seven generations. And if we step back and think about this for a moment, that means that every action I'm doing today, if I'm thinking about its effect seven generations from now, well then, maybe I'll choose to plant olive trees rather than get in the car and drive into town. Maybe I will make decisions that allow for more energy, for energy abundance in my community. And all of our decisions, if they're based, if they're reflected in what are we leaving our children and their children and all these generations in the future, if they reflect in this, if they're reflected in this thinking, then I think our world would be a very different place. Mm-hmm. And it has to be, because we're getting pushed to our edges. And in permaculture, there's something we call edge effect, which we can observe in nature. Like the edge between land and water are places where there's the most bioproductivity, where there's the most life occurring. And I say that now we need to look to that edge, that now we're on the edge of industrial collapse. And that now is an opportunity for us to look to each other and look to the earth for building systems of abundance around us and creating a world that can feed all people, that can bring back the ancient forests and thrive long into the future.
What can people take from this as far as like applying it to like their backyards or their communities? And do you have anything more to leave people with as far as like, you know, how can we not only survive industrial collapse, but thrive through industrial collapse?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah, so part of making this shift is understanding that every single one of us has a part in it. Not only are we making choices in our lives which add to the industrial collapse, like the kind of car we drive or the patterns of what we do in a day, but we actually have the ability, each one of us can apply this in our backyard by turning your lawn into a garden, by looking to growing food in urban areas. I mean, one thing that happens is that many urban areas, most of the food is grown outside, which actually takes the wild lands and turns them into these huge industrial farms. But if we were able to set up systems for food security in our communities, whether it's neighborhood through community gardens, or it's making use of everyone's backyards and front yards and sharing the abundance of food and medicine and fiber and seeds. These are all forms of making this change possible. And I think that as we start looking towards energy descent and industrial collapse, it's our relationships with each other that will see us through. And so I feel like now's a really good time to really start bridging with your community, to get folks together and just even start talking about this, seeing how people feel about what's going on in the world, and then coming up with some project, something focused. Because the more people we have, small groups of people, they could just be two or three or four people even, that are focused on, you know, on getting people to ride more bikes in their community, or on educating the community about passive solar design in new developments, or whatever it might be. That small groups of people can do this amazingly well if they come together around some sort of focus, and it can be quite effective in the community. And in fact, I always think to seed saving, because when I'm saving seeds, I'm always thinking about how my ancestors saved seeds, and that's how I got here. That the food I'm eating is I'm only eating this food because someone years and years and years ago were saving the seed of this food to enable to pass that on to the next generation. And these are sort of the decisions that we have now, is what do we pass on to the next generation, and how do we take action in allowing abundance and inspiring abundance in our communities and in our world.